Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Our guest today is Maxine Beneba-Clark, author of Foreign Soil, published by 37 Inc. Atria on January 3rd. Maxine is a novelist, poet, and editor living in Melbourne, Australia. She was the Hazel Rowley Fellowship winner for biography and also won the 2013 Victorian Premier Award for an unpublished manuscript. This, Foreign Soil, is Maxine's first book. And it's a collection of 11 short stories, stories that are full of pain, meanness, nostalgia, fear, monsters, sometimes happiness, and sometimes a bit of a harbinger of what America has done to itself with our election of Donald Trump. The stories are engaging, surprising, emotionally riveting and haunting, and each conveys something that at the time of reading the first word, one didn't expect. It's hard to do. They take place all over the world, America, London, Australia, Jamaica, Africa, yet they all knife us with a stark reality about the world around us, not necessarily a world we choose, but a world that increasingly and most recently closes in around us. These stories are different than what you're used to reading lately, and for that reason alone, amongst many others, I encourage you to come by the shop and pick up a copy. Welcome, Maxine, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the show.
So tell us a little bit about the journey of this book and how I, the descendant of Russian immigrants, here in Little Chester County, Pennsylvania, USA, am interviewing you, the child of two West Indian emigres, while you sit there in Australia. What's brought us together today?
Well, I think, in terms of what I wanted to do with Foreign Soil, I found myself, I didn't really know I was writing a book of short fiction, but I found myself, every time I would go to write a short story, it would somehow be about this migration movement around the world, how different people escape the circumstances they're born into or pushed into in their lives. And so I think that, you know, what you just kind of summarized in terms of our two backgrounds is really for me what intrigued me in trying to write a collection about this movement of people around the world. I feel like it really is the topic of our times and you know, how we grapple with that movement and as human beings, what can bring us together.
And it's funny how you do it, too. And in the first story, David, you do it with a bicycle. And the reader, it's good because you confuse the reader right away, which is always great. And you have this bicameral looking at things where I'm reading this story about this girl, that this bike she just got, which is so cool. And then all of a sudden, there's somebody else who's there. And he's going through something completely different in a completely different part of the world. And somehow at the end, and you do this in several of the stories, not all of them, somehow in the end, the thing that was supposed to happen happens, but it doesn't happen in the way it was supposed to happen, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I was really interested with this story. I wanted to write a story about, you know, a young African-Australian woman buying this bike from a shop in Melbourne's West. And having this encounter with this older African immigrant who's kind of very disapproving of her behavior. And at the beginning of kind of thinking about how am I going to join these characters, I hadn't come up with the bike yet. But I kind of, you know, writing is such a universal joy. You know, I love riding bikes. My kids love riding bikes. You know, it's a kind of almost like an ageless pursuit. And I was watching one day a documentary that was set in a refugee camp in Sudan. And just in the background as the reporter was talking, I saw this kid just rocketing past on this bike that was made of wood and rope and tin cans. And, you know, it was just this kind of amazing contraption. And it really just struck me that in this place that seemed devoid of all hope, these kids had somehow managed to make this bike almost out of nothing. And so that kind of became the idea to link these two women together.
And it's funny because each woman has sadness in her life, and you do this again repeatedly throughout the book. There's so much sadness, not to say it in a way that sounds bad, but there's so much sadness, but it always seems to, there's a reason for it. There's a reason for the sadness, and there's a reason why the sadness is resolved. But there's also violence. And then if you go to the second story, Harlem Jones, and it's funny how you, and we can talk about that later, how it comes back in the Sukiyaki Book Club story, but you have a violent youth who's, and I'm trying not to spoil any of the stories, but you actually do spoil that one, but and you have in interviews too, but you have a boy whose violence can't be changed. It's something that's kind of burned in, locked in. Where does that come from in your life, and why did you decide to stick with it against proposals by other people that perhaps, hey, maybe you're going a little too far?
Yeah, I mean, I think that story is set in Tottenham in London, which is where my father grew up. And in 2011, the area of Tottenham erupted into riots. They started because of the shooting of a young black man by police, but they were really, at the heart, they were really class riots. You know, this became a situation where an impoverished community, black, white, and all colours in between, just kind of took to the streets. And there were these kids that you know, were full of rage and were smashing the street up, and the police were appealing for, you know, people to come forward and identify them, putting forward their photographs. And I just saw these stills of these kids, and it was that question of, well, this is just a photo at that moment of rage, and how has this, what happened to this kid in the hour before this photo was taken, and in the months before, in the years before, in the lifetime before, to actually get to this point? And so that's what I was interested in exploring, was, well, you know, instead of looking at that end product of why are these kids, you know, smashing up this street, well, let's try and get a sense of who this person was and understand how they may have ended up where they are.
And the funny thing is that what you're able to do throughout the book is that the reader can sympathize with Harlem Jones, but you can equally sympathize with the cop at the very end who says, mind what you're doing, you really don't want to do this. He seems like a good person. He seems like a good person, and at the same time, you have a boy who you can't, it's hard to condemn him, right? So,
and that's, I guess I'm fascinated by that nuance in character, that, you know, Harlem Jones is, you know, he's endearing in some ways, but he's a very difficult character to love. You know, he's violent, he's full of rage, his brother's been sent to jail for, you know, massive spoilers here, but, you know, and then the way he treats his mother is completely misogynistic, and so, but, you know, there's never just one story, and so I guess I wanted to kind of hint at that this concept of good and bad, and that things are clear cut. It's not necessarily that simple, and I find it really interesting, I guess, to explore those blurred lines.
And then after I read that, I thought, oh no, all these stories are going to be like this, and I'm going to be really depressed. but then the third one was Hope, and Millie is just such a lovely person, and her paramour is such a lovely person and so well spoken, and. But you know where you really got me worried in that story? It was like in a movie where, like, so when the white man is doing what he's doing there towards the very end, and she uses the meter stick, I'm thinking, you know, they're not keeping an eye on him. They're not keeping an eye on him. I don't know if he's going to get back up. And do you know what I mean? Like in movies when that happens, when they're not watching the guy, and they don't take his gun away and they just let him there.
There you go. That's something I hadn't even thought of, you know.
I thought, well, that meter stick it's not that thick.
true. Maybe I needed to have him kind of claw his way back a bit more. But,
yeah. So I was really scared. Yes. I was scared because I wanted a happy end. I wanted this happy ending, and it was the happiest of endings.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that story was a great, it was a really fun one to write, and how I came to that story, the main character is called Millie. My maternal grandmother's name was Millie, but my paternal grandmother's is the one who grew up in Jamaica, and she had four kids, three kind of within her marriage, and then, later on in my life, I found out that there was this. I had an uncle that I didn't know about. She'd had this child when she was 16. And it was a similar situation to in the book. She went to, from the area she lived in, she went to the city to find a job. She fell in love with this very charismatic young guy, and she became pregnant. And I said to her, "What did you do?" She said, "I didn't tell anyone." And then I took this baby on the bus. I went back home. I knocked on my mum's door. I handed her the baby, and I turned around and got back on the bus and went to the city. And this is kind of, it's towards my grandmother's before she passed that she told me this story. And so I just became fascinated with this concept of, well, what would you do in that situation? What if you had a different ending? And so it was really trying to create that young girl and in a way trying to imagine what my grandmother would have been like at that age. Yeah, she's this very kind of feisty woman, but very wise in a way as well. Yeah.
The other thing about that story, too, is with the letters that were written back. And, I think I'm so smart, so I knew why the letters were thick. So I figured that out. And then I'm thinking, why did you?
Yeah.
And then it's like another one of those movies where they hide the letters and then they never get together because of it. And I thought, oh, no, this is going to happen. And you really got me.
Yeah.
I had to rush through the story, like, really quickly because
Yeah, I guess I like doing that, playing with things that the reader may know that other characters in the story might not know, and the way that plays into how someone reads the story.
It worked really well. That would make a lovely television show, and maybe it will. I think maybe you'll become rich and famous. But then after that, do you mind going through these stories like this? Is this okay?
No, it's absolutely fine. It's a pleasure.
Okay. So the title story, Foreign Soil, it really, the end of it just scared the heck out of me because I think what it does to a reader or what it must do to some readers is it makes you realize how tenuous your situation is, especially when you have the presaging of it when she's in the airport and people are coming up to her and she doesn't realize what she's gotten herself into. And then at the end of it, it's like, okay, there's nothing left for her to do. It's like, how did that was another one. Okay, so where did that one come from then?
I guess in writing, once I had a few stories, I was really exploring that notion of displacement and people moving to other places. And I didn't want it to be really a collection about third world migration to the first world or, migration to the West. I thought, this is something that displacement can happen no matter what your background is. It's really about being in unfamiliar surroundings and not having support. And so, this idea of a young Australian woman falling in love with this very charismatic foreign man, and also that notion of people's prejudices that they might not even realize they have, like this young woman, there are these warning signs, and because this is an African gentleman, a man from Uganda, she keeps saying, no, it's just my parents being racist, it's just, there's nothing here, there's nothing ominous here, it's just that, we've been trained to believe this, but in actual fact, it's really just a story about a situation of fraught domestic violence. And in a sense, I feel like it could happen anywhere. It could happen, on a homestead in the American South. It could happen in Australia. It really just is about that concept of someone not being who you think they are and being trapped by that person.
It's just that she's memorized the map, and that's what you did at the very end, is that if you're in Oklahoma or Melbourne or London, You know what's around you. You know there's houses, there's telephone poles, there's cars, there's stereos. But here, she's memorized the map, and she knows even to the feel of the earth what's around her. And that's what really, it's like the cask of Amontillado or something, you know? It's like Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
It's just, you know. And
it's that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like it's that, that geographical thing as well. What scares me about, I love traveling, but the one thing that I don't, that really, more than not knowing a language, or is that geography of, not like literally not knowing exactly where you are, or knowing but being unable to know how to navigate yourself around. And so she's trapped in this compound, she's not able to even go into the city to get her hair cut or anything, and just this notion of your world becoming really small.
And you also did it to me in this one too, because I knew what was going to happen when she was talking to the servant, and so then now I felt really bad for her, thinking, I wonder what she's going to do now. Now she's lost this job she's had for so many years, and she seems like such a nice person. And my mind is like traveling down with her, wondering what she's going to tell her family and all that. It was really funny how you did that.
That concept, I guess, of the we're kind of like ships passing in the night in a sense as humans, but these one interaction can just have profound consequences for the other person.
Well, look,
for both people.
The next story, the Shu Yi. And again, here's a woman, a girl who does something that's much like Harlem Jones does. And later on in Railton Road, that they do things that are so horrible, and yet you can't find it in your heart to condemn them, whether it's what she does to Shu Yi, what she says, and how mean-spirited and mean it is, or whether, and again, not giving things away, what's done in Railton Road. These things are so horrible, yet the reader is able to ascertain enough about the character that commits the act to make the reader understand why it happened, simply because she wanted to be a slightly different person than what she was. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel as if, this book, there's a lot, I guess, in this book to do with racism and race relations. And with those two stories in particular, I wanted to look at really lateral violence or what do they call it, horizontal violence, where
right.
You are, we think of racism as this, sometimes as this awful thing that white people do to black people. And it's really not that simple. So I wanted to explore, well, what happens when people are in situations of a disadvantage themselves, and they see an opportunity to step up and to somehow gain something by oppressing someone who might be in a similar situation to them, and kind of trying to explore that with sensitivity, so you can see a little bit of everybody's perspective and see that this is really just a system that everybody is affected by, that we're all living within, and all, doing awful things to each other in order to kind of make our way in this appalling system.
Well, it's like me being an American now, waking up, I'm a perfectly nice, very liberal person who thinks that things should just rock along nicely and everyone should be nice to each other and we should all be pleasant. And then I wake up one morning and I feel fine until I go, Donald J. Trump is president of the United States of America. And it's like, I feel like I'm in a Philip K. Dick novel. I feel like it's like Blade Runner. I feel like I'm in an alternate universe. And even today, just before I came over here, he's signing these executive orders that are horrible. You'll read about them, or you probably can read about them now. But, just getting rid of sanctuary cities completely, which your book kind of touches upon, and beginning the erection of the wall, all the things that, and you didn't know any of this when you, well, this book, tell a little bit about the history of the book, because it's not like you just finished writing it yesterday and it got published in America on January 3rd.
Yeah, it was a long time in the writing, and I was saying to somebody that the weird thing about this book is I hope it's quickly made obsolete, you know. I hope that this is, you know, I hope that people still read it, but I hope that very soon we're reading it saying, did things like this actually used to happen, you know, rather than reading it as a contemporary narrative. Because some of the stories I started writing, oh, probably seven or eight years ago, it was published in Australia 3 years ago, and, you know, particularly the stuff about Australia's immigration detention regime and our appalling human rights record, we're behaving worse, you know, as a nation towards asylum seekers now than we were 8 years ago when I started, you know, writing this book. And so it's been this, you know, this kind of almost awful realization of things that have been happening where the things that I'm talking about in the book have actually become more crystallized and more set in stone around the world than they were when the book first started being written.
Yeah, I know. Like, one of the executive orders Trump signed today was to reopen all the CIA dark prisons around the world that were closed in 2009 by Obama. It's like that. It's like your story. It's like your story, Stilt Fisherman. You're saying that all of that is not any better now, I guess.
Yeah, no, and in fact, it's probably worse. In the Stilt Fisherman story was when really most of Australia's processing of asylum seekers in what we call detention centres, which is essentially a jail. You know, you have mandatory jail if you arrive in Australia by boat. And they've now taken that offshore to a place called Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. So we've completely moved it out of sight now. Whereas when this story was being written, I'm writing about a detention centre that is a jail, but it's in Australia and it's in the middle of a suburban community. And so it's kind of reading back on it and thinking, wow, we're worse off than we were when I penned this story. And similar to the Trump, you know, the Trump issue, the story Aviation, I feel as if the sentiment in that story in terms of society's views of Muslim immigrants and things like that is potentially even worse now.
And it's funny how you one of the conceits that you utilize, especially in Aviation, is this dizziness. And that's how I feel too in the morning sometimes. It's like she has this dizziness when she approaches the little boy because she can't quite, just as in Stilt Fisherman, his blood is everywhere. It's almost, it's a hallucinogenic story, actually. But in Aviation, she has this dizziness and this inability to distinguish between what's happening in front of her and what happened before and how the two are connected. And it's uncanny that it's almost like you unfortunately, as you say, predicted things that have come to pass.
Yeah, I think there is this strange aspect of the book that that, as I said, things just kind of that even maybe when I was writing the story, I felt had been, you know, that we'd passed over as a society and we're starting to move forward with it. That all of a sudden we've been with the election of Trump, and not only that, I mean, even in Australia, we're leaning further and further towards the right in terms of the kinds of politicians
everywhere
that are being elected.
In Europe,
yeah,
too, in France, Marie Le Pen, or I don't know what's happening. But you did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Luckily, you the only thing Nathaniel Robinson has to worry about is a cricket team. That must have been
fun.
No, I was going to say that must have been fun because the dialect is so beautiful, and I don't know where you get that from either.
Yeah, I wanted to write about what Australians call the Calypso summer, which is, you know, Australia is, you know, there's a black indigenous population but Australia was colonised by the British, so indigenous people in Australia are about 2% of the population. And when I was growing up as a kid, you know, my parents of Afro-Caribbean descent, that they migrated here. They grew up in London. They migrated here in the mid-70s. And so it was a very white country when I was growing up. You know, we really didn't see many people of African descent. It was very, very rare. But in, you know, in the early 70s, they had what they called the Calypso Summer, which is the West Indian cricket team did a tour out to Australia, you know, and Australia fell in love with these black cricketers. It was this kind of strange moment in history where these, you know, very charismatic black cricketers with pronounced Jamaican accents became celebrities. You know, they're on all the primetime television shows and meeting the prime minister, and it was this kind of, what? You know, well, who are these people and where do they come from? And so I really wanted to write about what that would look like to a young Jamaican man reading about this in Jamaica at the time, and this, the assumptions that you would make about the kind of place Australia is, which wasn't really true at all. You know, there was still a lot of racism, a lot of discrimination in Australia at that time. But I wanted to play around with that perception, I guess, of reality and this kind of projection of the, that you would assume seeing these cricketers being paraded around like royalty.
Yeah, there's such a wistfulness with the last paragraph of that book. And again, what you did there is you juxtaposed the fact that Clarice is teaching him how to read, and he's kind of not fed up with it, but it's a hard task for him. But he makes it his job to make sure he reads the entire article.
Mm. Yeah, I wanted to have, I guess I wanted to have someone who struggles with education to kind of, you know, play on that idea of not really having an understanding of what's going on in the wider world, but someone who's also very smart, you know, that
yeah.
He speaks beautifully, he thinks beautifully, you know, despite the fact that he can't read or write or he's struggling to learn. But it was an interesting thing with that story where it was originally written in standard English.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept reading and rereading this story, and I kept thinking, there's something wrong with it. I can't figure out what it is. And then one day I just thought, well, it's because I'm using standard English that I know as, you know, an educated middle-class person in 2013 or whenever I was writing it, to kind of tell this story of this young, illiterate Jamaican man I suppose that's why I ended up writing it in this patois, was I wanted to show the beauty of this character's language and his culture, and kind of not be condescending with it, to kind of show that, look, even though this person speaks and hears a different kind of English, it is a very sophisticated kind of English.
Yes, that's the thing that came through, and that's what I was asking about how you do it, is because even me having to struggle with the patois, but not too badly, because you do such a good job with it, but you can read through the words into his intelligence, that he's an intelligent man, that he's a good man, that he's a kind man, that he's got a streak of sarcasm to him, that she's got a streak of sarcasm to her. So does that being able to write in that patois come naturally to you? And also, because I know a little bit about you from interviews and stuff, have you ever, like, do you ever stand up aloud in front of a crowd and like maybe read that story aloud?
Yeah, because my background before I, you know, started writing on the page was in spoken word, and I would sometimes read these, you know, my paternal grandparents were born in Jamaica, and my maternal grandparents were born in Guyana on the coast of South America, and so they had these heavy West Indian accents. They all migrated to London in the mid-50s and kind of raised their families in England. But I remember just growing up with this, these voices in Australia coming down the phone line of my grandparents, and having to, you know, when you don't have someone in front of you, you've got no visual cues and you're trying to understand a different accent. I just remember, you know, that just holding the phone really close to my ear as a 10-year-old and just, you know, trying to work out what my grandparents were saying, because I was used to this broad Australian accents around me that I grew up with. And so I think that's where it came from, was imagining what if the narrator of this story was a woman like my grandmother? How would she tell it, and how would that change the way that she actually delivers the story?
It was a lovely story. I really liked it. The one story that was, I guess, confusing to me in the sense that I don't know how in God's name you have the context to be able to write the story is Gaps in the Hickory, because you're here in my country, in the heart of a land of prejudice, at least a region of prejudice, and you're writing about a kind of a LGBT issue. Where did that one come from? Like I'm asking you on each of these, where did they come from?
Yeah.
Authors hate that.
I think yeah. No, that's all right. I look, the seed for that story came from you know, someone in my life to transitioning, and someone who was very close or played quite a significant role in my children's lives. You know, I've got kids who are now 6 and 11, and having to really, in a way, kids are very are less judgmental than adults. You know, they ask questions, but they're not, you know, really offended by anything. And so it was this really interesting notion of grappling with how, say, an 8-year-old would deal with the issue of, you know, a transgender person or someone who's gender questioning, as opposed to how someone my age or someone who's, you know, in their late 60s might actually approach this, and the kind of, worries and prejudices they might project. So that's really where the seed of the idea came from. And I decided to set it in the American South, in New Orleans, and in a fictional city called Market Town. Because I think partly because at that stage I knew I was writing a collection about race and about people in different places. And I also wanted to play with that idea of, you know, readers thinking, okay, this is going to be the Klan story. You know, it's set in the South, and it's, you know, it's going to be about the Klan, and it's going to be horrific. And you know, that aspect overshadows the story, but it isn't the story. The story is just about this young kid in a hyper-masculine environment. And in researching, I watched and read a lot about the Klan, and these two things came hand in hand. You know, this concept of white supremacy and of hyper-masculinity, and not really allowing anyone who strays from that to have a chance.
Yeah, I like the idea that, you know, the reader's thinking, oh, this is going to end up, like you said, like a night march and burning cross and something horrible happening to Carter or something like that. And then it was really smart that you insured yourself at the end by making Dolores the recipient of the largesse of his former partner. you kind of protected yourself at the end there, which was good, by leaving the house. So I think that's all of them except for Sukiyaki Book Club, and I saved that for the last because it is last, and also because you decided playfully to like break the fourth wall. But what were you thinking? Were you trying to like, not, I don't know, get back at people? Were you trying to say, look, I did it. I did what I want. I did it my way.
I think when I read it now, I do think, oh, gee, that was pretty vindictive, you know. But at the time, I had, you know, the book had been picked up by for publication by that stage, after probably about 2 or 3 years of trying to get this book into publisher's hands, get them to read it, you know. And my publisher said to me, look, this is, in terms of a collection, something like this hasn't really been done in Australia in terms of your geography and the different people you're into, different characters from different places. And, you know, would you write a story to finish off the collection that maybe is a little bit positive, you know, in terms of an ending, but that also will give people a sense of who you are? And I really struggled with this because I'm thinking, you know, I'm an Australian-born person of you know, parents who've migrated from London but were born in the West Indies. You know, my grandparents are obviously born and raised in Jamaica. They're the descendants of, you know, the Atlantic slave trade, so our origins are African. I thought, how can I possibly tell people who I am in one short story? And it just became more and more obvious that, no, I'll write the story of being a young Black Australian woman, or of a young Black Australian woman who has written this collection of short stories, you know, who's a single mother and who's just, you know, bashing her head against a brick wall, really trying to get people to notice this collection. But I also wanted to write about the area I live in. I live in a really multicultural area of Melbourne. in Melbourne's west, a place called Footscray, and it's a place that's not really written about. It hasn't really been written into Australian literature, well, not as much as it should have been. So I also wanted to have a look at that.
It was funny too, because you know, I liked the part about the possible publishers saying, you know, couldn't he just have a change of heart, you know, just at the very end.
Yes.
and then the other way you got me too was because I know you now, and so I'm thinking of Avery and Avery getting tired, and I'm going, what is she going to do to her? I mean, and then you tricked me, which was great because it was a great trick.
Yeah. And it's funny because I didn't know, you know, in a sense, I think that story is more meta than I intended, because I had this narrative of this little girl, you know, in a situation that she couldn't get out of, very simple situation in a schoolyard. And as a writer, as I'm working on the other narrative about a young writer, I'm thinking, how the hell am I going to get her down? You know, what am I going to do to make this? They want a happy ending, you know. And in the end, it's funny because it was so simple. It was like, of course, she just does a somersault and lands on her feet, you know. So it was kind of this, it was a really fun story to write, that one, actually.
Yeah, I'm glad it ended that way for a number of reasons. It was very well done, but I just was so impressed with it, and I just like I said at the very beginning, I just wanted to thank you for giving it to us. And now I have an independent bookstore here called Wellington Square Bookshop, and it'll be on the front table along with our other bestsellers. And I wish you the very best. And I think, you know, it's the kind of book that I think is going to really do really, really well.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much. It's been so lovely and great questions.
Thanks. Well, when you write a great book, it's easy to ask great questions. So, and hopefully someday you'll come over to the States when you do some major fancy tour and this is optioned to some film studio and all that, and then you can come by my bookstore and visit.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That'll be fantastic.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks. You too, Sam.
We were talking with Maxine Clark. Her book is called Foreign Soil. It's a debut. It's a debut from Australia. It's a debut of stories from Australia that you've never heard from Australia and probably won't for a while, because they have to catch up to her genius. I just was overwhelmed by it and didn't think I was going to be. I never know when Rebecca sends me a book whether I'm going to love it or whether I'm going to love it after I interview the author, because I always love them after I interview the author. But this was really something really special, not necessarily always going to make you laugh out loud, that's for sure, but will always make you think, and especially since I rag on Trump pretty much 24/7 and will, it makes you think of what's happening in the world today, what's happening in our country, what's happening if you go to whitehouse.gov and look at the executive orders that are being signed. In any event, thanks as always for coming by today. Our upcoming guests include Ilan Mastai, who will join us to discuss his highly anticipated debut weirdo science fiction novel, All Our Wrong Todays, and Steve Erickson, who will share his latest novel. And if you know his history, those are some really warped, strange science fiction ones. This one's called Shadowban. I've talked about it before. It involves the reincarnation, reapparition of the World Trade Centers somewhere in Arizona or Nevada. They just pop up one day in 2020, and in the 93rd floor is Elvis Presley's stillborn brother, now alive, knowing all the songs that his brother sang, looking like his brother, but not being able to carry a tune. And that's the concept of the book. And it's full of music and all kinds of music that I remember from growing up. Who else? Jamie Attenborough will discuss her latest novel, All Grown Up, which is kind of a chick lit book, which I sometimes struggle to get through, but this one's really good. So we've got three or four more besides that coming up. They're just not scheduled yet. In any event, thanks as always for coming by, as I said, and we look forward to being here next week with you for the Avid Reader.